Chapter 1 of the Life of Abbot Daniel. Among the other heroes of Christian philosophy, we also knew Abbot Daniel, who was not only the equal of those who dwelt in the desert of Seti in every sort of virtue, but was specially marked by the grace of humility. This man, on account of his purity and gentleness, though in age the junior of most, was preferred to the office of the diaconate by the blessed Papnutius, presbyter in the same desert, for the blessed Papnutius was so delighted with his excellent qualities that, as he knew that he was his equal in virtue and grace of life, he was anxious also to make him his equal in the order of the priesthood. And since he could not bear that he should remain any longer in an inferior office, and was also anxious to provide a worthy successor to himself in his lifetime, he promoted him to the dignity of the priesthood. 204. He, however, relinquished nothing of his former customary humility, and when the other was present, never took upon himself anything from his advance to a higher order. But when Abbot Papnutius was offering spiritual sacrifices, ever continued to act as a deacon in the office of his former ministry. However, the blessed Papnutius, though so great a saint as to possess the grace of foreknowledge in many matters, yet in this case was disappointed of his hope of the succession and the choice he had made, for he himself passed to God no long time after him whom he had prepared as his successor. Chapter 2. An Investigation of the Origin of a Sudden Change of Feeling. From inexpressible joy to extreme dejection of mind. So then we asked this blessed Daniel why it was that as we sat in the cells we were sometimes filled with the utmost gladness of heart, together with inexpressible delight and abundance of the holiest feelings, so that I will not say speech, but feeling could not follow it, and pure prayers were readily breathed, and the mind being filled with spiritual fruits, praying to God even in sleep, could feel that its petitions rose lightly and powerfully to God. And again, why it was that for no reason we were suddenly filled with the utmost grief, and weighed down with unreasonable depression, so that we not only felt as if we ourselves were overcome with such feelings, but also our cell grew dreadful. Reading palled upon us, aye, and our very prayers were offered up unsteadily and vaguely, and almost as if we were intoxicated, so that while we were groaning and endeavoring to restore ourselves to our former disposition, our mind was unable to do this, and the more earnestly it sought to fix again its gaze upon God, so was it the more vehemently carried away to wandering thoughts by shifting aberrations, and so utterly deprived of all spiritual fruits, as not to be capable of being roused from this deadly slumber even by the desire of the kingdom of heaven, or by the fear of hell held out to it. To this he replied. Chapter 3. His Answer to the Question Raised. A threefold account of this mental dryness of which you speak has been given by the elders, for it comes either from carelessness on our part, or from the assaults of the devil, or from the permission and allowance of the Lord. From carelessness on our part, when, through our own faults, coldness has come upon us, and we have behaved carelessly and hastily, and owing to slothful idleness have fed on bad thoughts, and so make the ground of our heart bring forth thorns and thistles, which spring up in it, and consequently make us sterile, and powerless as regards all spiritual fruit and meditation. From the assaults of the devil, when, sometimes, while we are actually intent on good desires, our enemy with crafty subtlety makes his way into our heart, and without our knowledge and against our will, we are drawn away from the best intentions. Chapter 4. How there is a twofold reason for the permission and allowance of God. But for God's permission and allowance, there is a twofold reason. First, that being for a short time forsaken by the Lord, and observing with all humility the weakness of our own heart, we may not be puffed up on account of the previous purity of heart granted to us by His visitation, and that by proving that when we are forsaken by Him, we cannot possibly recover our former state of purity and delight by any groanings and efforts of our own. We may also learn that our previous gladness of heart resulted not from our own earnestness, but from his gift, and that for the present time it must be sought once more from his grace and enlightenment. But a second reason for this allowance is to prove our perseverance and steadfastness of mind and real desires, and to show in us with what purpose of heart or earnestness in prayer we seek for the return of the Holy Spirit when he leaves us, and also in order that when we discover with what efforts we must seek for that spiritual gladness, when once it is lost in the joy of purity, we may learn to preserve it more carefully, when once it is secured, and to hold it with firmer grasp, for men are generally more careless about keeping whatever they think can be easily replaced. Chapter 5. How Our Efforts and Exertions Are of No Use Without God's Help. And by this it is clearly shown that God's grace and mercy always work in us what is good, and that when it forsakes us, the efforts of the worker are useless, and that however earnestly a man may strive, he cannot regain his former condition without his help, and that this saying is constantly fulfilled in our case, that it is not of him that willeth or runneth, but of God which hath mercy. 205. And this grace, on the other hand, sometimes does not refuse to visit with that holy inspiration of which you spoke, and with an abundance of spiritual thoughts, even the careless and indifferent, but inspires the unworthy, arouses the slumberers, and enlightens those who are blinded by ignorance, and mercifully reproves us and chastens us, shedding itself abroad in our hearts, that thus we may be stirred by the compunction which he excites, and impelled to rise from the sleep of sloth. Lastly, we are often filled by his sudden visitation with sweet odors, beyond the power of human composition, so that the soul is ravished with these delights, and caught up, as it were, into an ecstasy of spirit, and becomes oblivious to the fact that it is still in the flesh. Chapter 6. How It Is Sometimes to Our Advantage to Be Left by God. But the blessed David recognizes that sometimes this departure of which we have spoken, and, as it were, desertion by God, may be to some extent to our advantage, so that he was unwilling to pray, not that he might not be absolutely forsaken by God in anything, for he was aware that this would have been disadvantageous both to himself and to human nature in its course towards perfection, but he rather entreated that it might be in measure and degree, saying, "Forsake me not utterly." 206. As if to say, in other words, "I know that thou dost forsake thy saints to their advantage, in order to prove them, for in no other way could they be tempted by the devil, unless they were for a little forsaken by thee. And therefore I ask not that thou shouldst never forsake me, for it would not be well for me not to feel my weakness and say, 'It is good for me that thou hast brought me low.'" 207. "Nor to have no opportunity of fighting. And this I certainly should not have, if the divine protection shielded me incessantly and unbrokenly. For the devil will not dare to attack me while supported by thy defense, as he brings both against me and thee this objection and complaint, which he ever slanderously brings against thy champions. Does Job serve God for naught? Hast not thou made a fence for him and his house and all his substance round about? 208. But I rather entreat that thou forsake me not utterly. What the Greeks call EWS SFODRA, i.e., too much. For first, as it is advantageous to me for thee to forsake me a little, that the steadfastness of my love may be tried, so it is dangerous if thou suffer me to be forsaken excessively in proportion to my faults and what I deserve, since no power of man, if in temptation it is forsaken for too long a time by thine aid, can endure by its own steadfastness, and not forthwith give in to the power of the enemy's side, unless thou thyself, as thou knowest the strength of man, and moderatest his struggles. Suffer us not to be tempted above that we are able, but make us with us the temptation a way of escape that we may be able to bear it. 209. And something of this sort we read in the book of Judges was mystically designed in the matter of the extermination of the spiritual nations which were opposed to Israel. These are the nations which the Lord left that by them he might instruct Israel, that they might learn to fight with their enemies. And again shortly after, and the Lord left them that he might try Israel by them, whether they would hear the commandments of the Lord, which he had commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses, or not. 2:10. And this conflict God reserved for Israel, not from envy of their peace or from a wish to hurt them, but because he knew that it would be good for them that while they were always oppressed by the attacks of those nations, they might not cease to feel themselves in the need of the aid of the Lord, and for this reason might ever continue to meditate on him and invoke his aid, and not grow careless through lazy ease, and lose the habit of resisting and the practice of virtue. For again and again, men whom adversity could not overcome have been cast down by freedom from care and by prosperity. Chapter 7. Of the value of the conflict which the apostle makes to consist in the strife between the flesh and the spirit. This conflict, too, we read in the apostle, has for our good been placed in our members. For the flesh lusteth against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh. But these two are opposed to each other, so that ye should not do what ye would. 2:11. You have here, too, a contest, as it were, implanted in our bodies by the action and arrangement of the Lord. For when a thing exists in everybody universally and without the slightest exception, what else can you think about it except that it belongs to the substance of human nature since the fall of the first man, as it were naturally? And when a thing is found to be congenital with everybody and to grow with their growth, how can we help believing that it was implanted by the will of the Lord, not to injure them but to help them? But the reason of this conflict, viz., of flesh and spirit, he tells us is this, that ye should not do what ye would. And so if we fulfill what God arranged that we should not fulfill, i.e., that we should not do what we liked, how can we help believing that it is bad for us? And this conflict implanted in us by the arrangement of the Creator is in a way useful to us and calls and urges us on to a higher state. And if it ceased, most surely there would ensue, on the other hand, a peace that is fraught with danger. Chapter 8. A question. How it is that in the Apostle's chapter, after he has spoken of the lusts of the flesh and spirit opposing one another, he adds a third thing, viz., man's will. Germanus. Although some glimmer of the sense now seems clear to us, yet, as we cannot thoroughly grasp the apostle's meaning, we want you to explain this more clearly to us, for the existence of three things seems to be indicated here. First, the struggle of the flesh against the spirit. Secondly, the desire of the spirit against the flesh. And thirdly, our own free will, which seems to be placed between the two, and of which it is said, "Ye should not do what ye will." And on this subject, though, as I said, we can gather some hints from what you have explained of the meaning, yet, since this conference gives the opportunity, we are anxious to have it more fully explained to us. Chapter 9. The Answer on the Understanding of One Who Asks Rightly. Daniel. It belongs to the understanding to discern the distinctions and the drift of questions, and it is a main part of knowledge to understand how ignorant you are. Wherefore it is said that, if a fool asks questions, it will be accounted wisdom. 2:12. Because, although one who asks questions is ignorant of the answer to the question raised, yet as he wisely asks and learns what he does not know, this very fact will be counted as wisdom in him, because he wisely discovers what he was ignorant of. According then to this division of yours, it seems that in this passage the apostle mentions three things: the lust of the flesh against the spirit, and of the spirit against the flesh, the mutual struggle of which against each other appears to have this as its cause and reason, viz., that, says he, we should not do what we would. There remains then a fourth case, which you have overlooked, viz., that we should do what we would not. Now then, we must first discover the meaning of those two desires, i.e., of the flesh and spirit, and so next learn to discuss our free will, which is placed between the two, and then lastly, in the same way, we can see what cannot belong to our free will. Chapter 10. That the word flesh is not used with one single meaning only. We find that the word flesh is used in Holy Scripture with many different meanings. For sometimes it stands for the whole man, i.e., for that which consists of body and soul, as here, and the word was made flesh, 2:13, and all flesh shall see the salvation of our God, 2:14. Sometimes it stands for sinful and carnal men, as here, my spirit shall not remain in those men because they are flesh, 2:15. Sometimes it is used for sins themselves, as here, but ye are not in the flesh, but in the spirit, 2:16. And again, flesh and blood shall not inherit the kingdom of God. Lastly, there follows, neither shall corruption inherit incorruption, 2:17. Sometimes it stands for consanguinity and relationship, as here, behold, we are thy bone and thy flesh, 2:18. And the apostle says, if by any means I may provoke to emulation them who are my flesh, and save some of them, 2:19. We must therefore inquire in which of these four meanings we ought to take the word flesh in this place, for it is clear that it cannot possibly stand as in the passage where it is said, the word was made flesh, and all flesh shall see the salvation of God. Neither can it have the same meaning as where it is said, my spirit shall not remain in those men because they are flesh, because the word flesh is not used here as it is there where it stands simply for a sinful man. When he says, the flesh lusteth against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh, 2:20. Nor is he speaking of things material, but of realities, which in one and the same man struggle either at the same time or separately, with a shifting and changing of time. Chapter 11. What the apostle means by flesh in this passage, and what the lust of the flesh is. Wherefore, in this passage, we ought to take flesh as meaning not man, i.e., his material substance, but the carnal will and evil desires, just as spirit does not mean anything material, but the good and spiritual desires of the soul, a meaning which the blessed apostle has clearly given just before where he begins. But I say, walk in the spirit, and ye shall not fulfill the desires of the flesh. For the flesh lusteth against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh. But these are contrary the one to the other, that ye may not do what ye would. And since these two, viz., the desires of the flesh and of the spirit, coexist in one and the same man, there arises an internal warfare daily carried on within us, while the lust of the flesh, which rushes blindly towards sin, revels in those delights which are connected with present ease. And on the other hand, the desire of the spirit is opposed to these, and wishes to be entirely absorbed in spiritual efforts, so that it actually wants to be rid of even the necessary uses of the flesh, longing to be so constantly taken up with these things as to desire to have no share of anxiety about the weakness of the flesh. The flesh delights in wantonness and lust. The spirit does not even tolerate natural desires. The one wants to have plenty of sleep and to be satiated with food. The other is nourished with vigils and fasting, so as to be unwilling even to admit of sleep and food for the needful purposes of life. The one longs to be enriched with plenty of everything. The other is satisfied even without the possession of a daily supply of scanty food. The one seeks to